Chapter 11, The Divine Mood. Friday morning, April 1, 1977. I remember the feelings that seemed to permeate some of the days of my childhood, even without bringing to mind the particular details of any given day that might have given rise to those feelings. They surge back, and I can see that for all their exuberance, they lacked, in contrast to my present psychological state. It is as if the universe now has its own mood invisibly imparted everywhere, in which I move and think. Again, the closest analogy is to the moods of childhood, when it seemed that all things were possible and I was filled with an energy, zest, and sense of competence that vanished all too soon. But this atmospheric presence, with its knowing light, seems possessed of that mood to a superlative degree, radiating it effortlessly out of its own good intent or desire to please. Now, if such a mood everywhere demonstratable here is only a portion of other superlative characteristics, if I am basking in vast goodwill of some kind of psychological personage, then I can only say that the ultimate power of such a being is such that its moods sustain worlds. This is conjecture, yet no other explanation that occurs to me is satisfactory. Yet such a hypothesis presents its own difficulties, suggesting the presence of a God so powerful that its good nature creates and maintains immense realities. But what if the visage of such a God changes? What if the mood turns only a trifle dark? What happens if it is displeased? For conventionally understood hell would be nothing compared with the disastrous effects of such a gigantic goodwill turned into its opposite. That kind of rage and that kind of power would annihilate worlds beyond all hope. This idea reminds me, of course, of the old Jehovah, with man at the mercy of a capricious God who in a fit of anger sends down floods or storms upon the world. But in a way impossible to explain, the good intent of this atmospheric presence is such that any ill intent would dissolve within it, not be annihilated but transformed, automatically changed into its best expression, and at the same time I realize that destructiveness is simply the inadequate or poorly realized expression of a good intent. The psychology, if one can use the word in this regard, of such an atmospheric presence is such that it ever seeks the most creative, expansive, loving expression in such gargantuan terms that our usual ideas of motivation utterly fail us. It is basically nonsensical to give such a presence human characteristics, and my interpretation of what now I can only call a divine mood is most likely my translation of psychological realities as far beyond my understanding as a man's psychology is to an ant. There is an immense, I can only term it, loving permissiveness that imparts exuberance and zest such as I have never known, and I feel within myself the coming birth of a new kind of creativity, involving all of my own characteristics, abilities, and idiosyncrasies, as if each nook and cranny of my known being was preparing its own delightful surprise, expansion, and further expression, a challenge of the most extraordinary kind. As if in life you sensed the approach of a time when each area of your living was about to expand immeasurably, the smallest talent being magnified and coming into practical use. I possessed, I thought, some latent musical ability never used, for example, and I feel it somehow arousing within me, and I feel myself drawn toward expressions that on earth were beyond my means. This atmospheric presence seems furthermore, then, to possess qualities that act as potent psychological stimulants of the most profound nature. The words psychological growing medium come to mind, as if this atmosphere promotes psychic growth to the most advantageous degree, or provides a spiritual and psychological medium rousing the creative development of even the smallest incipient seeds of personality. Qualities and characteristics that I never suspected I possessed now surface within me so that I feel to myself like a garden ever coming to growth, containing far more flora and fauna than I ever realized, and as if earlier I had only identified with one crop of abilities that I call my own. A steady confidence sustains me also, and a stronger sense of balance than I have ever known, so that these euphoric feelings are not unstable or overwhelming, but taken quite as my natural heritage, adding a buoyancy to my subjective steps. To an extraordinary degree, I must have changed myself, then, from who or what I was, and surely my own demeanor reflects at least some portion of that spiritual resiliency and good intent that is not my lot. I find myself on occasion also possessed of a new emotion, or one so different in quality from others as to feel like an entirely original emotional sensation. It is a concentrated version of love, compassion, understanding, and creativity directed on my part to each of our own thoughts as if they are the most precious seeds psychologically packaged by me and sent through the universe forming their own species, beloved psychological infants springing from my creative mind that I free and send forth to grow and develop according to their nature, each to find expression, take hold, and hopefully thrive. Therefore, I find myself again, occasionally, bidding goodbye to my thoughts when they leave my mind, much like a parent who sends children out into the world for the first time. In some way, it seems to me that each of us was somehow sent out in the same fashion, and that we repeat the process anew whether we are aware of it or not. I wonder, of course, if it is fruitful to compare this feeling about my thoughts and my good intent toward them, regardless of their nature, with the more persuasive atmospheric presence and its attitude toward the universe and toward me specifically. For that magnificent good intent is strangely combined of impersonal and personal elements, of which I am sure. Intellectually, this implies a contradiction, though on an emotional level, none exists. This good intent is seemingly directed toward me because I am me, and I sense at least a deep understanding on its part of my subjective reality, a comprehension that far exceeds my own understanding of myself. On the other hand, if I were someone else, this intent would be just as powerful and as personally directed. Indeed, everyone with whom I have come into contact feels in the same relationship to that atmospheric presence as I do. I do not know whether still others, in other states of mind, perceive more or less of this divine mood or experience it differently, but the varieties of perception are so unlimited here that certainly such must be the case. I do know that this same atmospheric presence and knowing light also sustains earth, and now I can understand some experiences that in life I could not explain. Before I mention these, however, I want to theorize further about the nature of this atmospheric presence, and surely I can think of no more challenging activity than the exploration of what I can only call divine psychology. My present circumstances put me in that most creative and yet ambiguous position of observing a presence in no way like any I have known, in which I sense superb original and therefore mysterious characteristics. And yet my position is one in which my old methods of exploration and communication are obviously too weak and puny for the task at hand. The impersonal and yet personal nature of this presence leads me to make certain tentative assumptions of an intellectual and emotional nature. For now, at least, I can blend intuitions and intellect in ways impossible for me before, using one or the other separately if I choose, or blending them in any mixture, so that in the combined light a more expansive vision is possible than one alone allows. In so doing, I make automatic adjustments, each one presenting a different focus or view of the subject at hand, whatever it is, with each alteration bringing further understanding and giving me the keenest delight, as with new surprise, I see how mind and intuitions together ever open up fresh views and combinations. My thoughts do falter, however, when I try to verbalize, even to myself, the staggering implications of creativity grasped by my intuitions, even though my emotional realizations also lag and cannot follow beyond a certain point. It is as if this atmospheric presence were a psychological repository for all possible subjective beings of such import that no one could comprehend these at once or in any combination of times, and that each of us draws from that repository whatever it is we require according to our understanding and circumstances, whatever they may be, while simultaneously our own experiences also add to that supportive psychological framework. In it, personal and impersonal meet and blend, forming new combinations and creative versions. Friday afternoon, April 1, 1977. Much of what I feel and know conflicts drastically with the ideas of good and evil as held by most religions, and with like beliefs held by many religious mystics. For I see that repression is a denial of creativity, that evil acts are short-circuited, well-intentioned ones, or good acts poorly performed or executed in such a distorted fashion that they appear twice as grotesque in the light of their seemingly opposite good intention. Yet to say that evil acts are the result of twisted, malfunctioning good would have sounded like Pollyanna to me in my lifetime. A philosopher who avoids dealing with good and evil is no philosopher at all. Yet the profound truth is that there is no evil to contend with, and this profundity requires the most compassionate understanding of humanity and an examination of man's nature in the light of its best rather than its worst interpretation. Only such an explanation satisfies man's innate search for order and meaning, so that evil is not seen as a negative force in itself, or as an absence of good, but as the misdirected or distorted attempt to attain good. Only in the greater dimensions of good's actuaries and expressions do evil's lesser qualities and lacks have any meaning. It has been said, for example, that in my works I remarked also that religion has often served as a banner of ill will. It is certainly obvious that more murderous acts have been committed in religion or God's name than in the name of hate or revenge. Even wars conducted by nations against each other are fought under the misconception that good will result. Man agonizes over his ill deeds. He does not enjoy feeling guilty, and indeed, guilt would make no psychological sense at all were it not for the existence of man's innate good intent, however misdirected or distorted it may become. The sense of freedom emitted by this atmospheric presence is so energizing and refreshing, so conductive to creativity, that it is impossible not to realize that in life also, repression is a denial of creativity for whatever reasons. As long as evolutionary and Freudian concepts based on man's innate psychological duplicity rule, then man will believe that the opposite of repression is license and the release of savage or primitive drives which, left alone, will ruin civilization. The Darwinian self would have no reason to feel guilty about any of its acts, however murderous, if they served the end of the survival of the fittest. Yet no person alive is without feeling of guilt. Nor do Freudian explanations serve as anything but the flimsiest fantasies in explaining guilt, though belief in those fantasies reinforces them and programs experience, further distorting self-revelations under psychoanalysis and incidentally producing no real cures. Those theories have been so projected onto humans' experience that terms like murderous rages are misapplied to violent children's behavior, and Darwinian survival theories tacked on to Freudian presuppose the desire of sons to murder their fathers and possess their mothers sexually. Children do desire to possess the abilities and powers of adulthood, to emulate their elders in all of their ways of expression, including sexual ones, but the energy of that desire is in no way murderous, though that is set up as the normal pattern of desire and unconscious behavior. The Greek dramatists dealt with such themes, for they glorified in contrast, in good and evil, the heights of glory and the tragedy of the flawed character. But these were all seen in a greater light, in which reality teemed with gods, humans, demons, and multitudinous species between, with great tensions and creative dilemmas and interactions, while the Freudian self is stripped of all heroic actions or possibilities of greatness, left only with the untrustworthy libertine self that must be repressed lest it destroy itself and the civilized world, which it has, in a way never explained, managed to achieve. Monday morning, April 4, 1977. By comparing my own and others' psychic reality now with the general state I knew on Earth, I am able to see what errors of interpretation I made. Hopefully the following suggestions made in hindsight can serve others and stress man's need for the psychological theory that will encourage and not limit his psychic growth. In life, it is not what particular incidents or feelings we repress that cause difficulty, but the mental set or habit of repression itself, and our beliefs in the need for repression to begin with. Repression on a daily basis restrains and restricts us on every side, in thought and action alike, limiting our exuberance and expressions of love. The belief in a flawed self, the identification with a destructive, condemned, or fallen species, leads to a basic distrust of the self, to an oversensitivity to conscience, and it is precisely such feelings that caused my own almost constant state of melancholy in life. It pervaded all of my days and lay like a heavy weight upon my heart despite moments of joy. Each happiness, each cheering event, each achievement was then weighed against what I felt to be the greatest pragmatic reality of man's stupidity and evil tendencies, and against such a black mountain of flawed psychological slag, no act, however heroic, no achievement, however brilliant, could appear as more than one spindly flower of a gigantic garbage heap, soon to die and vanish, of no help in any way whatsoever, and no act, however well-meaning, could begin to affect the ultimate weight of man's plight. How could flawed creatures trust themselves privately? And in terms of a democratic government, how could man hope to rule himself? So it seemed that I must watch myself at every turn, double-check my theories and deductions, be triply cautious of my hopes for man or the existence of the soul. The more my heart yearned to find proof of the soul's existence, the more my mind mocked, for nowhere could I find in man's overall acts a justification for his survival. More than this, I feared that a faith would only lead to deeper disillusionment, that faith in man's good intent would not last a moment in the reality of this practical world. It seemed safer not to believe, for then the besieged heart could be hurt no longer, and could cease comparing man to an ideal that was unrealistic. Yet against this, I looked everywhere for the ideal. Jane comments, as I wrote this for James, I felt his purpose merge with mine, or mine with his, so that he and I both seemed to speak with one voice. This identification continued for the entire passage. End comment. But judging all man's acts against the ideal, and perceiving how short those acts fell in execution, I lost sight of man's intent. How, then, could I find success in the idea of a well-intended universe? For then all was right with earth and heaven, and the creatures and the stars, and only man stood out in a glaring flawed inadequacy. He alone marred what was otherwise an ordered universe. Yet if there was no order in the universe, then where did the idea of it come from, that my heart and mind alike sought it out and judged all discord against its implied existence? For I could not believe in the accidental creation of the universe any more than I could accept the accidental manufacture of a chair that happened to fit the contours of my body so perfectly that it just might have been made to do so. How loving and convenient the atoms and molecules just happened to fall in such an accidental yet precise fashion, and that I happened to have hindquarters that could take advantage of such a cosmic configuration. But for all of that, I could not get the feel of a well-intended universe to support me, to couch me as the chair did. And so, psychologically, I felt without support while my melancholy reminded me constantly of the dilemma. I grew disenchanted, and my disappointment with life and its conditions grew in proportion to the hopes for it that once possessed me. Even nature lost its magic. For the contemplation of its beauties only led me to a nostalgic wish that man and his works could in some way compare to that orderliness and grace. The inner atmosphere of my experience was then almost opposite to the state I am now enjoying. Yet in life I did have some sense of this freedom, and possessed hints entirely overlooked for the ease and motion with which I thought, and the actions of my thoughts themselves had the same swift mobility, safety, and ease. That is, my thoughts flew out from me in such profusion that I could never keep track of them. Their vitality had no bounds, and even the most pessimistic ones flew out from my mind with the same optimistic freedom. Sure that is of expression, and possessed of much agility as those more cheerful ones. Now, however, I am surrounded by the sense of psychological luxury and supported by that atmospheric presence whose qualities I find at once so curious and so familiar. This presence is responsive. I am sure that it reacts to me, yet while it is everywhere, it is not obtrusive, but again, like the summer day, it is more like a delightful medium in which all living is bathed, so that it is quite possible to forget it almost, or take it for granted. I say almost, because its qualities emerge upon you slowly, or did upon me, so that it was some time before I realized its responsiveness, for example. Therefore, I suspect that the dimensions of its existence reveal themselves, or are revealed, according to the attention one accords them. Again, as far as I can tell, this knowing light and atmospheric presence are the same, which is to say that at every hypothetical point this presence is wholly here and responsive, while still retaining its atmospheric rather than specific nature. And I know that I am cut from the same cloth, a self formed about me like the finest garment stitched according to an eternal pattern, tailored with multicolored beads of time, figured flesh without seams. And each self is put on, taken off, and worn again like a beloved article of clothing, never discarded or hung limply in the dark closet, but renewed, brightened, newer with each wearing, a living garment lovingly rendered. I can only compare this atmospheric presence, then, to some kind of creative psychological medium possessing within itself all of the qualities necessary for existence. A repository of individuation and perceptive abilities. As all the required elements for life spring up from the ground of the earth, which also nurtures them, this medium seems to perform the same services, only giving birth to the psychological entities and entire universe that sustains them. Wednesday morning, April 13, 1977. I am convinced, then, that this atmospheric presence is the creative medium from which all consciousness springs. This same omnipresent light seems to attract the smallest of my psychological seeds, buried or struggling for freedom, sodden from the overwatering of my melancholy, so that each hope rises once again. My heart becomes even lighter. More, this light is surely the same that in another fashion lit the skies of Boston, drawn over the ocean and splashed upon my study floor. But the quality of this knowing light differs, for it is alive with a loving intent, and it is instantly felt and experienced in a direct manner. There is no mistaking its intent, and again I am struck by the ambiguity of its vastly personal and impersonal aspects. Its atmospheric qualities, for example, its unobtrusiveness, may exist only at certain levels of understanding. For in a strange manner I was comforted by the fact that this presence did not seek me out, examine me, or attempt to overwhelm me in any way. Instead it quietly offers, what? Solace, support, a buoyancy in which my existence is everywhere strengthened, refreshed, and yet led to perceive enticing future developments, or rather to feel itself able to expand, even to be transformed in perfect safety. This offering of opportunity, however, also invokes my own peculiar individual tendencies, as if these and no other are uniquely vital and important, to be nurtured, as if these are the seeds of some future fruit, exotic plant, or special species, to be lovingly cultivated, or as if I can produce psychological seeds of immeasurable value to the universe, and this knowing light nurtures them more surely than on earth the sun nurtures the spring seedlings. Yet I am equally sure that each other person here feels the same way and is nurtured in the same fashion. And with no way to prove any of this, I know that on earth each person is also supported in the same way. There is no demanding quality to the atmospheric presence or its light. Yet it seems possessed of what I can only call a divine active passivity. It attracts but does not push, and yet its force is a passive one, in that it seems to exist in a state of attractive waiting or invitation. Ever welcoming, with a gigantic tenderness of power held in control, as if it were so aware of its own energy that it knows its most nonchalant caress could carry such strength as to squash the object of its love. This last statement, again, comes close to suggesting a super personification of the kind I've tried to avoid, and there are complications here also, most difficult to comprehend. Words and even my own impressions and limited perceptions may be misleading in this respect, in that I believe that comprehension of this atmospheric presence is automatically meted out according to the needs and conditions and nature of the perceiver. Again, I am reduced to analogies. But using the exotic plant simile, it is as if I am watered, nurtured, and given light in exact proportion to my own needs, not, for example, given too much light or overtended with fertilizer, rich comprehensions that my own rooted thoughts can take, but spontaneously receive exactly what I require. This suggests some cosmic, automatic, water-tending device of impersonal nature, leading to the complications I mentioned earlier. For I barely sense that this seemingly automatic relationship rests upon an intimate contact of the most personal nature imaginable, one deeper than any possible in what on earth is considered intimate contact. That is, this seemingly automatic nurturing, this meeting out of comprehension and light, seems to be based on an intimate, loving knowledge of my own state and being so complete that it spontaneously delivers what is needed before I realize my own needs, in a way more characteristic of a mother, say, than a father. And as a suckling's pressure on a cow's teat brings forth milk, so in some unfathomable psychological nurturing, the presence of man's needs automatically inclines his presence to bring forth whatever strength, understanding, or support is required. And as a mother gains satisfaction from nursing her child, so this atmospheric presence feels as part of any creature as that creature's mother is in the act of nursing, so that the seemingly automatic cultivation is more intimate, based on an impossibly complicated relationship. These analogies, sweeping from one spectrum to the other, served me poorly, yet I can think of no other way to imply the nature of this atmospheric presence. To grown men and women, the nursing analogy may seem distasteful, reducing the adult to the suckling infant, portraying man's state as one of dependent passivity. And such is not my intent. For returning to the complications just mentioned, to some extent or another, this atmospheric presence also actively desires to nurture, support, and bring us into being as, say, a woman for years unable to bear a child finally produces one and is overwhelmed with love, wanting to give it all things. At the same time that I reach for these analogies, it is equally difficult to assign either male or female characteristics to this atmospheric presence. And I realize that such gropings of mine imply projections on my part. Taking that for granted, let me continue. In the light of this presence, I do not feel subjectively an infant in the manner described, but sense potentials or psychological outlines that are mine to fill, as perhaps one person might sense within a loved one the full stature of personality that on earth, at least, is never possible to actualize. Thursday morning, April 14, 1977. The artist does not think of a sketch as a baby painting, but has respect for it as itself, though it may well develop into a painting, and he may have executed the sketch as a first step toward a painting. To that regard, the painting is implied in the sketch, and the artist may very well always see the painting's promise whenever he looks at the sketch. This is perhaps closer to the relationship between the atmospheric presence, the artist, and myself, the sketch. But in this case, the sketch is endowed with those possibilities of development itself, and in the presence of the knowing light, it feels its own existence drawn out of one state toward another, more fulfilling one. The earlier infant analogy comes easily, however, since in childhood, I now see that we accept such help automatically, taking it as our right, and in life, it is everywhere apparent except that man has closed his mind for whatever reasons to whatever is available. The earth itself is given, and all the requirements of life. Men and animals come into the world already equipped with fields, plants, water, air, each element fitting so perfectly with each other and each so contributing to the existence of the other. And its miraculous construction is so workable that man takes its existence for granted. But the earth is given. To imagine that such an entire environment is an accident is, I see now, intellectually outrageous as well as emotionally sterile. I also see how the religions partly understood and ignorantly distorted the qualities of this divine mood in which physical life has its being. Because man has set himself apart from nature, it seems that he must manipulate it to his advantage. He does not let it work for him as it wants to do, for nature also possesses a good intent, flowing as it does from this atmospheric presence. With man's attitudes, however, it follows that other people and institutions also seem to work against the individual, who then feels alienated from God and man, alone in a chaotic universe, a creature accidentally thrown into existence like a live coal from some gigantic furnace, sizzling for an instant with the crackling and rustlings of desire, but soon reduced to ash. With such theories, it is impossible to hypothesize about creativity, the worth of the individual, or the value of his actions, since all effects are ultimately destroyed and even their existence has no meaning. Man's undeniable creativity and the cooperative ventures of nature literally have no place in such an accidental universe, since these are also seen as the happenstance constructions of a system whose creatures have one intent only, the savage, competitive intent to survive, each individual pitted against each other member of its species, each species against each other species, each nation against each other nation, providing a picture in which indeed only evil seems to be apparent. In that contrast, not only is the universe accidentally formed, but its intent sets each element in it against the other, and cooperation takes place only out of self-purpose of the most selfish nature. If such a universe did indeed exist, the creatures within it would have annihilated one another in the dawn of time. In man's mechanistic approach to such questions, he ignores the meaningfulness left by even the smallest creature, and apparent in all animals' activities, the joyful, exuberant playfulness of nature that exists side by side with its more deadly attributes. Without that exuberance, that very joy of being, there is no reason for any species to continue existence. Yet man is fast creating the idea of a joyless world, and in so doing, restructuring his emotional life to fit the facts as he sees them, facts that nowhere fit the real scheme of nature, and seem to fit only because man steadfastly ignores other evidences to the contrary. This evidence exists in his own private experience in all of those realms that science deliberately considers outside of its scope, for it now considers unscientific any data that it has decided a priori might upset its official framework. These attitudes, abilities, characteristics, and experiences that might and would show the meaningfulness of nature's good intent remain as unacceptable data. Here I include the state of dreaming, the vast unexplored areas of altered consciousness, telepathy, clairvoyancy, and above all, the creative abilities themselves. For in man's use of creativity, he definitely allies himself with the meaningful universe and with the good, exuberant intent from which it springs.